American Novels. The NBC University of the Air presents Samuel Clemens' portrait of river steamboating in the middle 19th century, Life on the Mississippi, another in its series of books that live, American Novels.
The Mississippi, being in all ways remarkable, is well worth consideration. Calling the Missouri its main branch, it is the longest river in the world, 4,300 miles. It is also the crookedest river in the world, since in one part of its journey it uses up 1,300 miles to cover the same ground that the crow would fly over in 675. In 1542, Ferdinand de Soto stood on the banks of a new river, the first white man ever to see the Mississippi. But it was 230 years before the first keelboats and barges floated from the upper rivers down to New Orleans to be tediously pulled back by hand. You see, they did things slowly in those days. But by and by, the steamboat arrived. The rough and reckless men of the keelboats became deckhands or mates or pilots. The steamboats absorbed all commerce. The river was booming. It was the life of the land, and in that land, the steamboat was king. Hannibal, Missouri, a white town, drowsing in the sunshine of a summer's morning. The streets empty. A sow and a litter of pigs loafing along the sidewalk. Two or three wood flats at the head of the wharf. And the Mississippi, rolling its mile-wide tide along around the point below the town. And then around that point, a film of dark smoke.
Steamboat coming!
In a twinkling, the town is alive and moving, all converging on a single point, the wharf. And among the crowd, my younger brother Henry and I.
She's the Comet, Henry. Must be the biggest boat on the river.
Are you crazy? There's an anchor is twice as big. Look at that smoke, Sam. Think she'd bust a boiler.
She's in. She's hit, too.
Yeah! Watch that train front forward. Lively there. Snatch it. Fast again.
Oh, I'd hate to be under that, mate.
Well, keeping, I tell you. You're going to sleep over it? Forward with that barrel before I make you swallow it. You split between a tired mud turtle and a crippled hearse horse.
Wish I could talk like that.
Father'd have your hide for it.
Henry, look there. Look who's coming ashore.
Well, it's Will Barris. Hey, Will! Will!
Well, Sam, Henry, you're still alive in this sleepy burg?
We thought you were dead, Will. Where have you been?
Where'd you get those greasy clothes? They look fine.
Those are my working clothes, of course.
Are you a steamboatman?
I'm a striker.
What's that?
An apprentice engineer, you dunderheads. Boy, this town ain't much like 4th Street in St. Louis.
You've been to St. Louis?
Been there? What I could tell you.
Oh, there you go. Please get ashore.
Well, I gotta get back in the boat. Tell my girl Betsy I'll see her next trip.
Betsy's my girl.
Not anymore, she ain't. So long, boy.
Henry?
Yeah?
I gotta get on the river.
You know Father won't let us.
I'll get on anyway. I'll run away.
Yeah, me too, I reckon. I bet I'll be a captain and show that Will Barris.
Captain? Not me. I'm going to be the real man on a steamboat. I'm going to be a pilot.
It was not a new ambition. It was the dream of every boy in every town the length of the river. For pilot was the grandest position of all. And by and by, I did run away. No boat would give me a berth, so I got passage on an old steamer bound for New Orleans. She was the slowest tub on the river. And on the way down, I managed to get acquainted with one of the pilots. And when the boat was setting out again for St. Louis, I planned a siege against him. At the end of 3 hard days, he surrendered. He took me on as his cub and agreed to teach me the Mississippi from New Orleans to St. Louis for $500, payable out of my first wages after graduating. And with the easy confidence of my time of life, I embarked on the small enterprise of learning 1,300 miles of river. If I had known what I was about, I should never have had the courage to begin. It was the custom to set out from New Orleans between 4 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon. At this time, the waterfront presented 3 unbroken miles of ascending columns of coal smoke, flags flying, mates swearing, perspiring, half-naked crews, and belated passengers hoping to reach the forecastle companionway alive, but having their doubts about it. I joined Mr. Bixby, my pilot, in the pilot house, and watched him head her out for the open river.
Here, take the wheel. Shave those steamships as close as you'd peel an apple.
I took the wheel. My heart fluttered in my throat, but it seemed to me that we were about to scrape the side off of every ship in the line. I had my own opinion of Mr. Bixby for getting us into such peril, and I clawed the boat away from danger as fast as I could.
You! What in the thunder and tarnation do you think you're doing there, you lame-brained son of an owl? Give me that wheel!
In a moment, he had closed water and was trimming the other ships by handbreadth.
Listen, boy. The easy water's ashore. The current's outside. You gotta hug the bank going up and stay out in the stream coming down. Understand?
Well, I thought about it, and I decided I'd be a downstream pilot and leave the upstream to people dead to prudence. While I was thinking, I occasionally heard Mr. Bixby's voice.
This is 12 Mile Point. The slack water ends here, abreast this bunch of china trees. Now we cross over.
Well, I wasn't that much interested in the scenery, but I thought it was kind of him to try to amuse me. Our watch was finished at 8, and I turned into the Texas and went to bed. To my sorrow and amazement, I was roughly turned out again when it seemed that I had hardly slept. It was the midnight watch. There was beginning to be something unpleasantly like work to this business of piloting.
Hurry on there, boy. First rule of piloting, never be late to your watch.
But I'm sleepy.
Sleepy? Well, if that don't beat all. Yes, mate, what is it?
We've got to land at Jones Plantation, sir.
It was a dingy night. The shores were black and vague. Well, I thought, I wish you joy, Mr. Bixby, trying to tell one plantation from the other on this night.
Does Jones want to get off at the upper end of the plantation or the lower?
Upper.
Can't do it. The stumps there are out of the water. He'll have to get along with the lower.
My exhortation began to cool, and my wonder to come up. But Mr. Bixby put in for the shore. Presently, he turned to me.
What's the name of the first point above New Orleans?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Why, no, sir.
Well, you're a smart one. What's the name of the next point?
I don't know.
Well, this beats all. Tell me the name of any point or place I told you.
Well,
what do you know, then?
Well, nothing for certain.
By the great Caesar's ghost, I believe you. You're the stupidest dunderhead I ever saw or heard of. You, a pilot, ha! You couldn't pilot a cow down a lane. Why do you suppose I told you the names of those points?
Well, to be entertaining, I thought.
Why, you ignorant son of a two-toed donkey, you...
This was the red rag to the bull, and I was given a terrible tongue-lashing. But by and by the storm subsided, and Mr. Bixby became quiet, even gentle.
My boy, you must write down everything I tell you. There's only one way to be a pilot, and that's to get this whole river by heart.
I made allowances. I was sure he was stretching it. By now, the night was as black as ink.
What business, Bixby?
Jones Plantation.
I wish I dared offer a small bet that it wasn't, but I held my tongue.
All right there. Clothes are off on both.
Here you are, Mr. Jones.
Good. Is that you, Clem?
Yes, sir, Mac Jones. Keep the chopper fast.
Set her back on both.
And soon we were standing up the river again, all serene. Accident that had ever happened. Well, I learned to be a tolerable steersman by daylight, and before we reached St. Louis, I'd made a trifle of progress in night work. I had a notebook bristling with the names of towns, points, bars, bends, but it was only in the book. But when we set down from St. Louis again, I was totally lost. You see, the river was turned round. My heart broke. It was plain that I had all this to learn from both ways. Well, this time we were on a much finer boat, and the pilot house was full of pilots out of work, going down to have a look at the river as they always did when their boats were to lay in port a week. These were fine fellows, and I was a cipher among them. I sat in a corner, and what I heard took all the hope out of me.
Jim, how'd you run Plum Point coming up?
Well, it was in the night. I ran it the way one of the boys on the Diana told me.
How's that?
I started out about 50 yards above the wood pile on the false point.
Yeah?
Held on the cabin till I raised the reef, quarter less plain.
Oh?
Straightened for the middle bar till I got abreast the one-limbed cottonwood in the bend.
Oh, yeah.
Got ahead in the low place above the point. Came through a booming, 9.5.
Pretty square crossing.
Yes, but the upper bar is working down fast.
Well,
now, if my ears heard aright, I must get up a warm personal acquaintance with every old snag and woodpile for 1,200 miles. And I must know where they are in the dark. Oh, I wish the piloting business was in Jericho. I rose the next day in low spirits. But before that evening, I was to have proof of the man who was teaching me. We were anxious to get to Cairo before nightfall, but suddenly the other pilot grounded the boat, and it was plain the darkness would catch us a good way above the town. There was only one chance. If we could make the dangerous Hat Island crossing before dark, we could venture the rest. But it was sober talk and a good deal of looking at watches as sunset drew near. And finally...
Well, yonder's Hat Island. We can't make it.
Too bad. Just a half hour sooner.
Come on, let's go down.
Wait a minute.
Huh?
Bixby's not ringing the land.
We bore steadily down the bend. The gloom was deepening. Inquiring looks passed from man to man. I knew about the Hat Island crossing. The great steamer must pick her way through snags and blind reefs, and then pass within arm's reach of a sunken wreck that could tear the hull timbers from under her in a second. The sky darkened. The stars came out. The men drew together behind Mr. Bixby.
Well, out. He's going to try it.
Starboard lid there! Starboard lid!
Speed slackened. The cries of the lead's men went on. The eyes in the pilot house strained into the dimness.
She's over the first reef, all right.
The stern's coming down just exactly right, by George.
She's in her marks. Over she goes.
Oh, it was done beautiful, beautiful.
The engines were off now. We drifted with the current. A blacker gloom closed in on us. It was the head of the island, the shoalless water. The pilot stood shoulder to shoulder, Mr. Bixby's back.
She'll not make it.
Shh, quiet.
Stand by now.
We've touched bottom.
Let her have all the steam you got, partner. Clear hard down. That's her.
She's over. She's over.
Man, Jim, I never saw the beat of it.
By the shadow of death, but he's a lightning pilot.
I studied harder than ever. I packed my head full of islands, towns, and bends till I could reel off a string of the names without leaving out more than 10 miles of river in every 50. I would begin to get complacent, but Mr. Bixby would be waiting.
What's the shape of Walnut Bend?
Learn the shape of the river. Learn it by day and by night, coming up and going down. Learn the shape of the river, a shape that was changing every 24 hours. I said about it. I began to get the best of it. And then Mr. Bixby said,
how much water did we have in the middle crossing at the hole in the wall the trip before last?
How do you reckon I can remember? The leadsmen are singing through that crossing for 3/4 of an hour.
You've got to remember. You've got to know every show place between St. Louis and New Orleans. And remember, they change all the time. You can't get them mixed up.
When I do that, I'll be able to raise a dead. I haven't got brains enough.
Drop that. When I say I'll learn a man the river, I mean it. I'll learn him, or I'll kill him.
I put such a strain on my memory that even the shoal water began to stay with me. But it was not enough.
See that long, slanting line in the water?
Yes, sir.
What's under it?
Water reading. Learning that the long lines were bluff reefs, and the fringe ends of the lines were the head of the reef. Learning that a slick, greasy-looking place marked water to shoal for a crossing. And then, the first moment I was left alone on the watch, my terrified sprint for the shore, trying to get away from what looked like an endless bluff reef. The boat was almost climbing a tree when Mr. Bixby stepped into the pilot house, as calm as he could be.
Stop the starboard. Stop the larboard. Set her back on both. Come ahead on larboard. Point her for the bar.
I'm glad you came in, sir.
What in the world could you want over in the bend?
I was getting away from a bluff reef.
Not a bluff reef within 3 miles of here.
Oh, I saw it. It was as bluff as that one yonder.
Just about. Run over it.
But...
Run over it.
I held my breath. But we slid over the reef like oil.
I don't understand.
Nothing but a wind reef. The wind does that.
But how can I tell? They look exactly like the watermarks of a regular reef.
You just tell. You just naturally know one from the other.
And in time, I just naturally did. A pilot must live with his trade all his hours and all his days. It's of little use to him to be perfect one trip and imperfect the next. It's a matter of continual concentration. Mr. Bixby told me once of a trip he made with an excellent pilot named Ford. It was said of Ford that if he had a bad piece of river on his mind, he could not forget it, even in his sleep. One night, nearing Helena, Arkansas, Mr. Bixby had the watch. The weather was sullen and dark. The water was low and the crossing badly tangled. Mr. Bixby had every light in the boat muffled and was worrying his way through the gloom when...
Who's there? I can't see you.
It's me, Jim. Ford. Let me take her. I've seen this place since you have. So crooked I can run it myself easier than tell you.
Go ahead and take her. I've been spinning around like a squirrel. Mighty kind of you.
Bixby sat down, and a marvel of steering began at the wheel. Easily, patiently, Ford stood the big boat in her marks. She crept by inches, and then, under a tremendous head of steam, went swinging over the reef to safety.
Partner, that's the sweetest piece of piloting ever done in the Mississippi. Thought I could steer a boat, but I see that's another mistake of mine. Say, will you hold her 5 minutes more while I run down and get some coffee?
A few minutes later in the Texas, Bixby was biting into a pie when...
Who's at the wheel, sir?
Ford. Why, what's the matter?
Get to the pilot house, quick! He's gone.
You bet he's gone. Didn't you know that lunatic was asleep when he came up here?
What? Asleep? No.
Sure. I found him walking the railings and put him to bed. Must have got up again.
Well, I hope he does it often. You should have seen him.
If he can do such gold leaf, kid glove, diamond best friend piloting when he's asleep, what couldn't he do if he was dead?
Yes, it was things like that that made piloting the more exciting to me. But there were other things that made me wonder. I've made it clear what a pilot's memory must be. Nothing short of perfection will do for it. But there were two higher qualities which he needed also. He needed good and quick judgment, and he needed courage. Give a man a trifle of pluck to start with, and by the time he's become a pilot, nothing can unman him. But the young cub, with his pilot at his side, often thinks his courage higher than it really is, until he's left alone. It is the pilot's duty to train his cub so that he may look danger calmly in the face. And Mr. Bixby trained me.
Island 66 coming up, Sam.
Yes, sir.
I'm going below. I suppose you know how to run the next crossing.
Why, it's the simplest crossing in the river. There's no bottom to it. I can run it with my eyes shut.
Oh. You think so, do you?
Why, yes.
Go ahead, then. See you later.
And he disappeared. But unknown to me, he gave certain orders. Presently, the captain stepped onto the hurricane deck just below me. Then the chief mate. Then a clerk or two. By the time I reached the head of the island, there were 20 people watching me.
Mr. Clemens!
Yes, Captain?
Where's Mr. Bixby?
Gone below, sir.
That did the business. The dangers began to multiply faster than I could count them. My head spun. I thought I saw shoal water ahead. My confidence vanished. I pulled the bell for the leads so feebly that I could hardly hear it myself.
Stop and let there! And quick!
I began to climb the wheel like a squirrel. Deep four in a bottomless crossing. I stopped the engines. I was helpless. We were drawing nine. I could not pull a bell. I shouted to the engineer.
Oh, Ben, if you love me, back her. Quick, Ben, hold back the immortal soul out of her. Mr. Bixby. Oh, Mr. Bixby.
I felt meaner than the meanest man in history. I set the wheel and came ahead on the engines.
That was a fine trick. I suppose I'll never hear the last of how I was ass enough to heave the lead at the head of 66.
I hope you won't. Did you know there was no bottom in that crossing?
Yes, sir.
Well, then, next time, don't let your confidence be shaken so easily.
It was a good lesson, but hard learned. And the hardest part was that for months, no matter who I met...
Oh, Ben! Oh, Ben, if you love me, back her!
I've dwelt long on the science of piloting, since I loved the profession more than any I've followed since. The reason is plain. The pilot in those days was the only unfettered human being on earth. Every man has a master, even kings. But the Mississippi pilot had none. The pilot was a great personage. He was supreme. All his wishes came as orders, and he could play the gentleman on every hand. But because the steamboat trade held the place of honor, every steamboat man was looked up to in the landsman's eyes. The degree of prestige, of course, depending on the dignity and fame of his boat. In the poor quarter of New Orleans, you could hear a woman shout through a window, very willing that the neighbors should hear.
You mad ass, you get Joe in the house here this minute. Stand out there and fool along with that low trash. Yes, the Bible off the Grand Turk wants to converse with you.
You could see a big, husky boy strutting through the New Orleans streets, eyeing the girls, giving himself airs, until he was indignantly approached.
Listen here, you. You's a-making yourself mighty fine, Pierce Lark.
And what then?
And then I'd like to know just who you think you is.
Who I is? I'll let you know mighty quick who I is. I'll let you know, count to understand, that I fires the middle door on the Alex Scott.
The kings of the river, The Cruise of the River Queen. My apprenticeship was drawing to an end. The goal of my boyhood dreams. And in due course...
Well, Sam, you need two signatures in your application to the government for a license. Here's mine.
I was a pilot at last, and I prospered. But then came the war between the states. Commerce languished, and my occupation was gone. So I left the Mississippi, and 20 years passed before I saw it again. And when I came back to the river, all the life I'd known there had died. I could not recognize the face of the river itself, so completely had it changed. And on the levees of St. Louis, half a dozen sleeping steamboats, where there had been miles of wide-awake ones. And the steamboat man was gone. No longer did he make populous the bars and the billiard rooms. The pilot who ruled with such absolute sway is absorbed into the common herd. For his occupation is outmoded. The towboat and the railroad had done their work. Mississippi steamboating was born about 1812. At the end of 30 years, it was a giant. And in 30 more, it was dead. Strange, so short a life for so majestic a creature.
Life on the Mississippi by Samuel Clemens is one of America's novels, brought to you each week by the NBC University of the Air. Listen next week to a radio version of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving. And remember that there's a world of entertainment and information to be found in your local public library. Many American novels in the 1947 summer series are included in the useful handbook of the World's Great Novels, which you may obtain by sending 25 cents to World's Great Novels, Post Office Box 30, Station J, New York 27, New York. That's Post Office Box 30, Station J, New York 27. Life on the Mississippi was adapted for radio by Clarice A. Ross. The music was composed by Emil Soderstrom, and the orchestra was directed by Joseph Galicchio. The entire production was under the direction of Homer Heck. Sam Clemens was played by Arthur Peterson, the young Sam by Johnny Coons, and Bixby by Nelson Olmsted. Others were Helen Malone, Bob Debler, George Kluge, Cliff Norton, Jess Hugh, and Arthur Young. This is Don Elger. This program comes to you from Chicago and is a presentation of the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations. How would you feel if your child were starving to death? It's a shocking thought. And yet, thousands of children are starving in Europe today. Food is desperately needed, and you can help by sending Care food packages. For $10, CARE guarantees delivery of a 21-pound, 41,000-calories package. Or send $4 for the special smaller food package. Send your name and address with your contribution, and you'll receive a signed receipt on delivery. Help prevent starvation in Europe this winter. Send your contribution tomorrow to CARE. That's C-A-R-E, CARE, New York. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.